Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome everybody to Lost River Legends. My name is Brett and I am one of the hosts of the show. James, our other host, will be joining us in just a few minutes. We hope everyone's Friday is great. We hope everyone is safe and happy, and we are glad that you're with us today. And in today's episode, we're traveling all the way over to New England from East Idaho, and we're going to be talking about the Bridgewater Triangle. The Bridgewater Triangle is a highly concentrated paranormal hotspot located in Massachusetts. And this Bridgewater Triangle, this location, it is ripe with all sorts of paranormal activity. We have everything from UFOs, Bigfoot, alien creatures, and just a ton of other weird stuff, and it's awesome. And to have us learn more about the Bridgewater Triangle, we reached out to Jeff Bellinger. And Jeff Bellinger is an author, a paranormal researcher, and an adventurer. And he just knows an incredible amount about the history of Massachusetts, the history of the Bridgewater Triangle, and all the activity and all the paranormal happenings in that area. It is a wild ride and it has some really, really crazy stuff going on. And so Jeff and I and James all sit down and we discuss the Bridgewater Triangle and we try to get to the root cause of what is causing all of this paranormal activity. And in all honesty, there's a history lesson that we find out about the Bridgewater Triangle and about Massachusetts that I have never heard of before, and hopefully you have never heard of either. So strap on your tinfoil hats and take a drink of your favorite beverage and sit back and enjoy.
All right, everybody, we're joined today by Jeff Bellinger. He is a co-host of New England Legends, mostly in Massachusetts and up and down the East Coast. And Jeff has also been featured in the Bridgewater Triangle documentary. You can watch that on Amazon. Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. We really look forward to some of your insights regarding the Bridgewater Triangle.
Sure. Well, so I started as a newspaper reporter 20 years ago, and I got hooked around October writing about ghost stories, and that eventually turned into a website, and then I started writing books, and then I started working in television. And early on in my career, like, my first book was called The World's Most Haunted Places. I investigated places all over the planet, and I think I fell into the trap of thinking all the really cool, interesting places are far away from where I live, which is a trap a lot of us fall into. And then you forget that where you live is far away for most of the world, you know? So I worked on a book called Weird Massachusetts back in 2007, which was part of the Weird US series. And that's when I started really focusing on where I live, which is Massachusetts. And that's when I also discovered the Bridgewater Triangle. I didn't discover it. Lauren Coleman actually wrote about it in 1980 in his book, Mysterious America. And I've known Lauren forever. He was really the first one to coin it. But since then, lots of us have started looking into all the strangeness that's been happening in and around this area. And for those who aren't familiar with Massachusetts, the area is kind of southeast of Boston and northeast of Providence, Rhode Island, in this that part that starts to go out where Cape Cod looks like a flexed arm. It's on the mainland right before Cape Cod. So that whole area there is the Bridgewater Triangle. It's roughly 220 square miles, and it incorporates the towns of Abington, Rehoboth, Freetown, but really that's just the traditional triangle. If you look into this area and look at all the strangeness, you can easily double the size of it And we found UFOs and monsters and ghosts and cult activity, you name it. It's a lot of weird stuff for one small area.
Well, and that begs the question, you know, why do you think this is such a magnet for this type of activity? It's like a vortex per se.
It does, and it seems very highly concentrated.
In this specific area,
obviously, that's why why Lauren coined the term the Bridgewater Triangle. It's all right in that area.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked because I've given this a lot of thought. And first, I want to ask a serious question, and you may know the answer, but have you ever heard of the King Philip's War?
Yes. Yes.
Because you watched the documentary, you cheater, right?
You got me.
Okay. Before you watched the documentary, had you ever heard of the King Philip's War?
I had personally not heard of it.
No, yeah. I hadn't either.
Yeah. And by the way, if you live anywhere outside of Rhode Island, Eastern Connecticut, Massachusetts, Southern New Hampshire, Southern Vermont, nobody has heard of it. Maryland has never heard of it. Delaware has never heard of it. Pennsylvania has never heard of it. This war, which took place between 1675 and 1678, was the bloodiest conflict in British or American history, even to date, per capita, meaning the largest percentage of people were wiped out during this war than any other war, than World War II, everything, right? All of them together. We're talking about like 75 to 80% of the Native American population were wiped out, as were like 30% plus of the colonists. It was just a devastating war that ravaged this whole entire region. And the epicenter would have been in and around the area we now call the Bridgewater Triangle. When we were growing up as kids, and I assume you went through the American school system, right? I mean, you guys, both of you, Brett, James?
Yes.
Yep, absolutely.
November, you remember, you know, in school, being in elementary school, and you'd dress up like pilgrims, and someone would be the Indians, and there would be turkey dinner, and we would celebrate this wonderful thing, right? This meal, because the Native Americans got those early pilgrims through those first few winters, 1620, and we celebrate it the fourth Thursday of every month. Every year we do it, and we watch football, and we eat too much, and then we, you know, sit down and try to digest all that food. And so that's such a wonderful story. And if you fast forward just a couple of decades, it gets really ugly. You know, what happened was more and more colonists kept coming and coming and coming, and they needed land and they needed a place to live. And the Native Americans are basically being pushed off their land. And at some point, there's an uprising. And this guy named Metacomet, who's a Wampanoag chief, who the English called King Philip, as in King of the Indians, leads this uprising, saying, guys, if we don't stand up right now, they're just going to keep coming and they're going to push us all off our land and they're just going to wipe us out. And what began was really guerrilla warfare. It was awful. It was as bad as you can imagine. You know, sometimes the Native Americans would sneak into colonial villages and murder everyone, men, women, and children. And the colonists would do the same to encampments of the Native Americans. Nobody was fighting fair. Everyone was fighting dirty. Everyone was fighting for their lives. The colonists really couldn't go back. You know, they were committed at this point, and the Native Americans are fighting for their home, where they live. And it was just absolutely awful. And the thing that's really amazing to me is that when people think of Massachusetts, one of the most iconic events that everybody thinks of is the Salem witch trials, right? Of 1692.
Right.
The Salem, everybody's like, oh, Salem witches, the witch trials. And yet when people discuss the witch trials, what's almost always left out of the discussion is the King Philip's War, which had just taken place a couple decades earlier. To put it in some context, I know it feels like I'm jumping around right now, but I swear it's all going to come together. So the Salem witch trials, you had people accusing from the pulpit, saying the devil walks among us. His minion are among us. And you would hear stories of just a couple of villages away where Native Americans, who your minister has told you are heathens in league with the devil, they're not Christians, have come in and wiped out people. So when someone says the devil is walking among us and he is out there to harm you, it was easily believable. This is not too abstract for the people of Salem in 1692. But yet we just don't talk about the King Philip's War. we take that out of the equation when it was a huge thing. I mean, today, if you said, oh, there's the devil walks among us, I mean, people would just say, oh, well, you're being metaphorical, and that kind of thing just wouldn't happen today because we're out of the context of a real war, a bloody, nasty one that's taking place in your backyard. So this King Philip's War is awful, and it comes to a head, and it finally ends April 12th, 1678, at a place called Annawan Rock, which is right in the middle of the Bridgewater Triangle. And they're promised, Annawan is promised by Benjamin Church and a lot of other colonists, just surrender, turn over your wampum belt. We'll all go peacefully. Just you and a couple of the chiefs will go and stand trial, but no one's going to die. And they didn't keep their word at all. Everybody was pretty much marched to Plymouth and wiped out. And to me, that's a stain that just has never washed away. And the wampum belt, which is an interesting thing, the wampum belt is this symbolic physical thing that's made of wampum, which is almost like these silvery shells. It's the equivalent of the king's crown jewels. It's very valuable, but its symbolic value is higher than its monetary value. So this is like the king turning over the wampum belt as a sign of surrender, but the people should have got it back, and they never did. And so you've got this stain, you've got this lie, you've got this broken promise, all in the shadow of the place where Thanksgiving was born, and we've pretty much wiped it from the history books, this King Philip's War. And that is really the epicenter of the whole Bridgewater Triangle. I feel like, for me, one of the things I've said before about hauntings is that a haunting is like history demanding to be remembered. You can ignore it, but it won't ignore us. It just kind of keeps coming up. And I think a lot of these legends demand us to go back and ask those questions. So when weird stuff is happening in the Bridgewater Triangle, I want to go back. Well, what happened here? Well, there were cult murders here. That's true. That did happen. Well, what happened before that? Well, before that, there was, you know, the mob used to dump bodies in Freetown State Forest. That's true, too. Well, what happened before that? And if you keep going back and keep going back, eventually you come to this huge, huge event called the King Philip's War that nobody in America knows about. And even here, right here in eastern Massachusetts, it's still not openly discussed because it completely undermines the entire holiday of Thanksgiving. And so we are still reckoning with that, I think, centuries later.
That's super fascinating, the connections that you reach into there. I think that we all kind of get the dose of the crucible. You know, we get that in school, and we think that these are some, you know, crabby, crazy girls are kind of out to get each other. That's kind of how that's painted. And then, of course, we don't hear about King Philip's War whatsoever. So, yeah, it's good to reach back, put things in perspective, and say, hey, these things happened. Could they be interrelated? Maybe, you know. And I think that actually draws a lot more of a level-headed view of things for us to assess at this point.
And it's,
yeah,
and it's historically accurate, right? I mean, it seems like the narrative has been not focus on the King Philip's War and how bloody and nasty and just terrible it was, and let's focus on and spin a narrative that's different. And now look what we have today when we talk about, you know, Thanksgiving and whatnot.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. And I know some local Native Americans. They're incredible resources. And I've done projects with them where we've interviewed them about these very topics. And they don't celebrate Thanksgiving. And by the way, like, I'm a fan of Thanksgiving. And I'm a fan of these people that were here long before us, right? And so I guess in my mind, I still very much celebrate Thanksgiving, and I look at it as like, well, what am I grateful for? What am I thankful for? That's always a good thing to celebrate. But I think we should at least understand the whole picture and kind of reckon with it. You know, history is told by the winners. It always has been. That's true the world over. And yet the losers, and I hate to call them that because sounds terrible, but the people that didn't prevail, they contributed quite a bit, and their legends, their lore is still very much around today. And to me, that's the mind bender right there, right? So when we're talking about a legend, and when I say legend, I mean the story that evolves around a thing. I don't mean to say or suggest that I think it's based on a fiction or a falsehood. In fact, quite the opposite. I think sometimes there really has to be some sort of catalyst that takes place that gives rise to one of these things. So if I were to make up some ludicrous legend, like, you guys, you're not going to believe this, I saw the Loch Ness Monster. And you'd be like, really, Jeff? Wow. You know, where? Well, it was in Times Square in New York City, like just dancing around some taxi cabs. And at that point you go, oh, dude, you're crazy. You're nuts. And you won't repeat that story because it's stupid. It's out of context. It doesn't make any sense. There's nothing that backs that up. And that legend won't go anywhere. But when we put it into the context of where it belongs and why it belongs there, then it sort of survives. When I hear about a place being haunted, when I hear about a monster lurking in the woods, I mean, that's not up to me. That's not up to you guys, right? Like, we don't make those decisions as to where these legends lurk. We hear about them because this is all of society saying there's something there. You don't have to believe in it. You can say it's just a story. You could say there's no such thing as Bigfoot or aliens or ghosts or monsters. It's fine. That's okay. But you can't deny the actual legend. The story behind the thing can't be denied. And that is powerful, and it's such a great starting point for me. When someone says there's a monster that lurks in these 100 acres of woods, I'm going. I don't expect to see anything, but I'm going to look, damn it, right? I mean, how do you not?
Yeah, I think that's something that both James and I, when we found out that when we originally reached out to you and we dug into your profile and a little bit more of your background, we found out that your podcast is called New England Legends, and ours is Lost River Legends, based out of Idaho, and we're separated by how many thousands of miles, and we're very, very curious, and we both have, all of us kind of have this sense of, you know, what's the truth behind all these things? Is there any historical connections? And so that's something that James and I have always had in common, is we're always driving towards truth, and even if that means delving into the strange and the uncomfortable, we're willing to go into that for a price, right? You know, we have to have some skin in the game, and it's interesting that a lot of the historical accounts have changed over the years, and that's so frustrating because it makes it harder to find what the truth is, and so. And this King Philip's War is the perfect example.
Yeah. So, but legends do that, right? So they're fishing stories, and that fish I caught was this big, and then your arms go a little bit wider the next time you tell it, right? And so part of that, and that's why we all have to understand how folklore works. And folklore is wonderful. It's an oral tradition. It connects one person to another and another to our past, and it's wonderful. I love it. I love, love, love folklore. And the story is going to change and evolve. And the reason for that is because we're all natural storytellers. So, for example, let's say you guys did some pretty cool athletic thing, right? Like you just climbed El Capitan, right? You scaled it. And now you start telling someone about it. And you trained for it and you worked hard. And let's say you use ropes, unlike that other maniac who, you know, is amazing, but you use ropes, the whole thing. And then you start going like, yeah, I made it up El Capitan. And then I lean in and I go, really? How long did it take you? And then you start telling me the story of the thing you just did, which is not paranormal at all, right? You used ropes and climbing and hooks and all this other stuff. But you start to naturally embellish your story the more you tell it. And that's only because you see your audience lean in and go, and then you were hanging by how many feet? Oh my gosh. And how deep was, how big was the crag you were walking along? And the crag might literally be 18 inches deep. And then the second time you told it, you're like, it's maybe a foot, you know? And then like the fifth time you told it, you're like, it was about 3 inches. I had 3 inches to just keep my toes on it, you know? And people going, wow, you don't mean to, you're not a bad person. You're a good person, but you can't help but react to the way people are reacting to you. So folks like us, the good news is we become magnets for these stories. When you're out there as someone who does a podcast or writes books or produces television shows and things like that on these subjects, sometimes when something weird happens, they call you right away or they email you right away and say, this just went down last night. I don't know what to make of it. At that point, you get your best shot at getting the story right before the rock face shrinks from 18 inches to 3 inches, right? Like, we're still out there in the original story. So we got to do our best to take a picture of it. When I'm collecting these accounts, I realize, and like my podcast, the New England Legends podcast, what you're hearing is this is where the legend stands today, right? This is what we know today. A year from now, it's going to change. New people are going to go. New stuff's going to happen, and it's going to become part of the story, or maybe more prominent parts of the story will surface that aren't there right now, because that's how it works. But that doesn't mean it's based on lies, and it doesn't mean that there isn't truth within there. You just got to follow the trail back. And the amazing thing is we live in a time when we've got great tools to do that. One thing, if I could get in a shameless plug for someone who gives me no money whatsoever, in fact, I pay them for their service. It's the Newspaper Archive is like one great service that I use all the time, where you can search centuries of newspaper archives all over the world and look for your keywords. And sometimes you find an article from 100 years ago that sort of mentions, like, well, we heard this place was haunted because of this. And you go, all right, 100 years ago, they were still talking about this story, and that's what it looked like then. How has it changed in the last century, and so on? You know, and we've got Ancestry.com, which allows you to check, you know, the lineage of various people. And you've got so much information that's coming online digitally. Archive.org. I'm just plugging away all these websites that most of them are free. Well, not Ancestry and not Newspapers Archives, but, like, you know, a lot of these resources. Archive.org has got all these digitized books and things like that. You can search them, and it's incredible that the library that exists today that didn't exist even like 2 years ago, this stuff wasn't out there. So we can search. And if you don't search, if you don't go back and look, then you're lazy. And I don't like lazy. Lazy offends me. You know what I mean? Like, we're not perfect. We're not infallible, but damn it, you should go look.
I was about to ask you, what are some of your methodologies when you get a call like that? What's kind of your process? What's kind of the way that you assess that and log the data? You don't have to get into any proprietary methods, but I'd like to know.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, like, I don't think there's anything proprietary about it. Research is a process. It's not a destination. And the comforting and horrible thing about research is that you will never get there. And you just have to accept that. You know what I mean? Like, imagine going on a journey, like, and you know you're never, ever going to reach your destination. That's very frustrating. Not everybody is cut out to handle that. But that's how research works. So you could say, like, I'm going to research the history of the White House, for example, which there's so much public information available on that building because we all pay for it and sustain it. But you're never going to know every little thing about it. You could spend the whole rest of your life, you know, you'll early on, you learn the big stuff. Oh, when was it built? Who was the architect? How many people built it? How many bricks? How many this? How many that? Like, who approved the plans? When was it designed? Who moved in? Those big things you find fast. But then you start getting into the minutia. And the minutia can make you crazy because there's always more to know. There's always the guy that designed the door frame of the East Room. I mean, 99.999% of the public is never going to care, but maybe you do, you know, and maybe there's a story there. And so for me, it's just kind of following the trail. If someone says there's a ghost, okay, well, who lived and worked in this place? Do any of those people match the descriptions of the witnesses? Why do we keep talking about it? You know, to me, that's the biggest question I want to know is why. And at the end, we can only speculate. But yeah, you follow the trail. You start with the big stuff and you get deeper and deeper as you go, and just accept that you can get close, but you'll never, probably never fully know everything you can know about a region, a building, a legend, a story, even a person. Because one of the strange things that happens too is, like, for example, let's say you find someone's personal journal from like the Civil War. And you read it and you go, well, there it is. He said he did this heroic thing. You forget how much people used to lie in their journals, you know what I mean? To make themselves sound amazing, because they knew people would read these things. They knew that it wasn't just for themselves. Some folks, I'm sure, tried to be really honest, but others weaved quite a tale in their journals where you go, whoa, wait a minute. That guy's journal doesn't back up what your journal says at all. You know, these other guys said you were a coward and ran for it, you know? So I think you just got to keep digging and keep digging.
Well, with that said, I'd like to know. So I understand going into it without like a huge expectation of closure, but have you ran into, specifically with the Bridgewater Triangle, have you ran into where the phenomenon itself seems to kind of cover its tracks? I know that that's been said, and people say that's true of places like Skinwalker Ranch, the Chestnut Ridge, and other areas of high strangeness.
I don't even like that term, because again, I think you just didn't work hard enough. When you say that, I think what you're saying is, yeah, I didn't want to look into it anymore. I went as far as I was going to go with it, and which is a more honest answer, right? But what sounds way more intriguing is to say, you know, ooh, it covers its tracks. No way. Nothing covers its tracks. Everything is, unless there's just one witness who died and never wrote it down, I mean, then sure. But I think with the Bridgewater Triangle, what's happened is we look at so many different things and then start to place it within the triangle. I mean, literally, because these events took place in the region. So, for example, the cult murders in the early 1980s, I mean, that happened. There was a cult out there. There were girls murdered in the woods. I know the guy that investigated it. I know I've seen the crime scene photos. I'm horribly sorry to say. These things occurred. And the thing about cults, like real cults, especially dark ones, they don't want to be found. And so when they do something illegal, then there are people who it's their job to find them, the police, the investigators, and so on. So the cult murders take place and people start digging, and you hear stories, you know, when someone sees like a pentagram or a 666 spray painted on a bridge, everyone thinks like, oh man, there's a satanic activity. No, that's just some kid being a punk, right? That's someone in high school just being, you know, stupid. A real cult hides. A real cult doesn't want you to find them. And so they had this shack out in the Freetown State Forest. And to get to it, you would have to basically, they'd have, like, for example, little things of silver in the moonlight. And you'd walk along and like picture a little piece of like aluminum foil, where if it's daylight, you're not really going to see it. But if it's moonlight, it'll sort of shimmer and guide your way. I mean, creepy stuff, you know, that gets you there. And then you find out what happened. And then you find out they were using girls' bodies for altars. And then you find out that they were actually killing some of these girls. So that takes place. And all of this just adds to the darkness. You know, like, this is indisputable. It happened. It's police record. Murder. The King Philip's War. You had correctional facilities in that area. You've got a military base not too far away, Air Force Base. So maybe that explains some of the UFO stuff. You know, you've got the Hockomock Swamp, which is the largest wetland in New England, that was then cut up by two major roads when they put in Interstate 495 and 24. They basically carved up this wetland, and that wetland was a sacred place. You know, this was a place for the Native Americans, but also a place where they had an advantage fighting against the colonists, because if they could draw you in there, they knew the terrain. And if you don't know it, you're at a real tactical disadvantage. So, man, all these places have stories. And if you're thorough enough, I don't think the tracks get covered. I think they actually reveal themselves more and more and lead you back to one place. And to me, that one place is the King Philip's War.
Thank you for expounding on that. I mean, I think that that perspective, I mean, you're boots on the ground. This is something that you're involved in. You're looking into on a very common basis. So, you know, expressing that angle of things, like, you know, you're really there putting in the work. So therefore, that's a great conclusion that you draw from that. One of the things I wanted to ask about has to do with, you brought up the Air Force base.
Yep.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about the UFO situation and how, if at all, it feels like it's connected back to some of those other phenomenon.
So for me, the UFOs are interesting. You do have an Air Force base. Our government does occasionally test top secret aircraft. However, they don't test top secret aircraft over major metropolitan areas like, say, Boston or Providence, Rhode Island. This is a heavily populated area, the Bridgewater Triangle, right? I mean, if you go from Boston down around to Providence, down around to Connecticut, where there's the submarine base, you know, electric boats down there and Groton and so on. There's a lot of people that live in that area. So the whole idea of testing top secret aircraft in one of the most populated areas of the country doesn't seem smart to me if I was in charge of top secret aircraft. So I think we can rule out a lot of that. I do sometimes think that various planes are flying over in formation, and that might confuse some people. But at the same time, we get these accounts of one of the most common one in the Bridgewater Triangle is that the craft is shaped like home plate, like a square with a triangle on it, which to me is really amusing because the Red Sox are a really big deal up here, right? Like people live and die by the Red Sox. And so baseball's on everybody's mind. And once someone said home plate, then that's what other people have seen too, which is interesting to me. But some of the earliest UFO accounts go back to the 1600s. The governor of Massachusetts entered in his governor's log, and it's right there for public record. I'm going to paraphrase, but it was basically this gentleman, a sane and sober man in good standing with his church and community, witnessed a fire in the sky that looked like a glowing swine or a pig that moved between Muddy River, which is a river just south of Boston, and Charlton. And so it just basically watched for 3 hours in his little boat as this glowing pig thing moved back and forth in the sky. And he had noticed that his boat, which should have been carried at least a couple of miles downriver during that time, had hardly moved at all. That way, I just paraphrased pretty much the whole entry for you. And so that what's interesting is the guy that witnessed it was a hog farmer. So that was a symbol that was familiar to him, was a pig, a swine. And nothing flew back then. This was the 1600s, the early 1600s. So we had no flying aircraft, no balloons, nothing. And so there is that was the first documented UFO sighting in America, really, in American history, as far as written down as a flying object that was indeed unidentified. So we have a tradition that goes back centuries of seeing strange things in the sky around here. If you were from another planet, I would guess this would be an interesting area to view, given all of its history, all of its human history, and all of its human activity between the Air Force, the Navy, submarines down in Groton, Connecticut, and then all the population that lives here. So, or if you were a foreign government, I guess it would be an interesting area to spy on as well. Not that they were spying in the 1600s with flying pigs, but maybe it might explain some of the more recent ones, but still those things come up and then we scratch our heads and we look for reasons why.
You know, it's interesting that he described it with something that he knew that was within his reach.
Right.
And you get that over time, of course, things morph, like the term Bigfoot, that term wasn't really around till, you know, the mid-60s, late 60s. In that time, and before that, it was, you know, wild man or beast or,
right,
you know, different terminology. It's just interesting to see that morph over time. And now that we're kind of more of in a technological age, a lot of things get, you know, discounted. Oh, it's a meteor. It's a SpaceX test. It's a, you know, on down the line of knowns. Things kind of get attributed to. So it's funny.
Yeah. And so at the end of the day, I think everybody wants to be able to sleep at night. So someone who does not want to believe in UFOs or aliens or whatever are going to label it as, you know, swamp gas or weather balloons or whatever. I'm okay not knowing. I'm okay leaving a question mark. You know, I can live with that. I think there's so many things in our world and our lives that are question marks that I'm at peace with it. I'm at peace with not being able to define it. We see that with conspiracy theories too, which is really fascinating. You know, whether it's 9/11 or Sandy Hook, some people would rather believe a lie than the reality, which is the world is chaotic, the universe is chaotic, horrible things happen at random. They'd rather believe that there's someone in charge behind it than the horrible truth, which is we live in chaos. So and the other thing that's great too is what you said, you know, calling it wild man or calling Bigfoot, by putting a label on a thing, it completely gives us this false sense of control, right? If I call it Bigfoot, well, now I've labeled it. Now I've given it a name, an idea, a concept, and lumped it together into this larger category. And now I feel a little better. It's just a Bigfoot. Whereas the reality is we've just slapped a label on something that we really don't know and really don't understand.
Yeah. To be able to compartmentalize it, I think our brains really like that. You know, we like to
put
that label on it, put it in that folder, file it away in that file cabinet. And then when you see or hear something that's similar, it goes into the same category. It falls in the same file, so to speak.
Sure. And we do that with regular people too, right? I mean, if you work in a crowded office, right? There's the funny guy, there's the big girl, there's the brown nose of the boss. Like, we label everybody. We put everybody into categories just to sort of keep track of them, especially as we get older, because we know, like, oh, I don't get along with that type of person. So you therefore are that type, you know, and you're this type and you're that type. And we do it all the time. Everything has to be in a neat little box. And I get it. We all need to do that to survive. But I also think it's a disservice to the world around us, because in reality, we don't fit in boxes. The world doesn't fit in boxes. It's a lot of gray area out there.
You know, you bring up a good point with the whole Bigfoot thing, where as soon as you label something, then you have control over it, or you have some certain power over it that makes you feel better. And For some people, you know, they say, well, now I know everything about Bigfoot because they're interdimensional. They break trees up high. They make forts out of branches. They do this. They do that. You know, they have these migratory patterns. They start really opening themselves up to really making themselves feel like they really have these things down, like they've been living with them and studying them scientifically for decades.
It is. And the funny, and I remember when I first started in this was, you know, keep in mind, like 20 years ago, you know, you start reading the theories and you go, okay, this is how all this works. All these situations and so on fall into these boxes. And the longer I've been at this, the more I realize, man, I don't know anything. I know so much less than I did back then, but I do know that there are a few commonalities among pretty much every paranormal account, every paranormal story, whether it's Bigfoot or aliens or ghosts or telekinesis, anything, right? There is always, 100% of the time, without fail, a living human being in the equation somewhere, and usually multiple living human beings. Bigfoot does not exist without a human, right? Ghosts don't exist without a human. Aliens do not exist without a human. This is a super egocentric way to look at the universe, but I can't help it. I am a human, and it's all I have to work with. And it goes back to the old, you know, the old question: if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? And I can actually give you the definitive answer to that. And the definitive answer to that is it doesn't matter if it makes a sound or not. That is the truest answer to that old, you know, adage, right? Because if a human's not there to hear it or witness it or experience it in some way, it's irrelevant whether it made a sound or not.
Well, you bring up a really interesting point, and I think about how there are those experiments that, you know, particle accelerators, where they know that there's a difference between when it's observed or not,
right?
And so there's this different outcome of these. You know, what's going on there? So if it can affect particles, can it affect the outcome of different experience and different phenomenon?
So I think the shortest answer to all this stuff, right, is that, and I'm totally stealing a quote right now, but the universe is not only weirder than we comprehend, it's weirder than we can comprehend. You know, I mean, we are incapable of getting into the head of God. for lack of a better term, if you don't believe in God, universe, grand designer, whatever the label you want to use. So it's so, so strange out there. And it makes me wonder, what's the other thing that is the other thread that goes between all these different stories and legends? And one is living human witnesses. The other one is time. And that's something that doesn't get talked about a lot, is that maybe every one of these things makes perfect sense somewhere on the timeline, but not right now, not in this moment. Ghost is the most obvious. If you're in Gettysburg and you see a Union blue soldier like walk by, that soldier does not belong here right now, but probably did belong there in the 1860s, right? It would have made perfect sense then, does not make sense now. If we extrapolate from there, right, Bigfoot might have made sense somewhere on the timeline. Maybe we're talking hundreds of thousands of years ago. Aliens might make sense on our timeline. Maybe that's what we're destined to look like, those grays with the big heads and and we have skinny little arms and fingers because all we do is text and that doesn't build muscle mass, right? Maybe that's what we're going to look like in like half a million years. Maybe that's what we're going to look like in like 10 years. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, our eyes are just going to bulge out from just texting and screen time and kicking and all this other stuff. And our brains are going to get bigger and bigger from the radiation, and our arms are just going to atrophy to nothing.
You know, and you bring up a really good point when you talked about, you know, we don't know because we can't get into the mind of God. And I feel like in our current generation, for the last maybe 20, 25 years, we've always been trying to improve upon the human limits, right? Whether we're adding machines to our bodies to increase strength or speed or agility, or now the advent of artificial intelligence, where we're trying to synthesize technology with our own bodies to understand things even more. You got these supercomputers that are, you know, oh, they're so smart and they can understand and do way more than a human can do. And we're always pursuing these things so we can understand more. And I feel like that's a natural human condition that we're in. I don't agree with it. I think that it's dangerous, but I understand why people are doing it, you know, trying to be faster, better, stronger, smarter, to understand things even more. And I think I don't think we're going about that the right way. I think there's other ways we can do that. But it's interesting nonetheless.
It is. Well, but you know, what's the old expression, right? You can't stop progress. And that's true. However, I think that's one of the reasons these legends resonate with us so much, is because the past does have lessons to teach us in all kinds of ways that we may not even fully comprehend just yet. And if we get haunted by something, if we hear about a monster, a strange lights in the sky, whatever it is, then we start to ask questions, and we start asking the biggest questions that humans have ever asked in all of history, right? Are we alone in the universe? What happens after we die? Do we know every creature that walks the earth with us? These are the biggies. These are the big questions that humans have asked since we crawled out of the primordial soup all those millions of years ago. And to ponder that is to ponder your place in the universe. And that's kind of beautiful. You know, it's something that's pretty magical to do in a time when we're losing connections with each other because of, like you said, technology and progress and all this other stuff. So these stories, these legends kind of call us back to a really primal place. And that's a pretty cool place to be in if you can get there.
You know, and it is. And I think that with how strange and how unknown our world is, even after all of our advancements and progress, we still are only just infinitesimally scratching the surface of the big unknowns that you had just mentioned. And I feel like, you know, our life expectancy on this world, depending on, you know, religious beliefs and whatever aside, we have to take advantage of the things that really matter most and really focus our energies on the good that we see in the world. And, you know, I personally believe in a place after death. And I feel like our consciousness, our essence, our spirits, if you will, those are the things that define who we are, and we'll definitely hopefully see additional understanding and whatnot afterwards.
Yeah. Well, that's the hope, right? That's that someday, someday, you know, someone says, here, sit down next to me, Brett, uh-huh. let me tell you what it all means. And you go, oh, thank God. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for telling me. That's the hope.
Yeah. But you know, there's so many unknowns in the world. And I definitely feel like our minds, our understandings are limited. They're dialed down, way dialed down to where we just can't really understand everything. We can't comprehend it. We can't compute it. And hopefully one day we will get to that point where we can. But you know, I know we're kind of drawn a little bit close on time, but I was hoping that you could share a story maybe from the Bridgewater Triangle that stands out to you, because we're kind of moving into the realm of the UFOs with Lost River Legends with our podcast, kind of exploring that. Is there anything in the Bridgewater Triangle timeline that you can share with us about a kind of a strange UFO incident that really stands out to you?
Well, I think when it comes down to some of this stuff, you have to look at the credibility of the witness. And one of the sort of recent and most credible ones came from news journalists who were going into work really early in the morning. And they were the ones that identified this home plate thing in the sky. They saw what they saw and they reported it, because that's what reporters do. You try to be as objective as you possibly can. They never said little green men. They never said Martians. They never said anything. Just there's a home plate flying through the sky over the Raynham Dog Track, which is right in the middle of the Bridgewater Triangle, and heading on over in this direction. And they talked about it. And to me, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's as good as we're going to get. Today, though, we're all carrying video cameras with us at all times, right? Our cell phones are also video cameras. Some footage was captured just about 2 years ago. And if you'd allow me to go just west of the Bridgewater Triangle in central Massachusetts, a local reporter pulled over because he saw these two triangles in a starry night sky that were silently intersecting with each other, moving around slowly and so on. And he was filming this, and then like a car drives by and just, you know, the car goes by and then they're filming him again. And the reason that car driving by is an important part of the story is that the phone picked up the sound of the car driving by, but nothing in the sky, total silence up there. And this went pretty much viral. The local television news stations were reporting it, that, hey, this was seen by hundreds of people. Tons of people called it in and so on. And the Air Force Base out in central Massachusetts made an official remark about this video and clip and everything that people were talking about. They said it was a C-5 aircraft coming in for a landing. And if you live out in that part of the country, that part of Massachusetts, a C-5, they do land at the Air Force Base there. And a C-5 is one of those planes that's so big, like the nose cone lifts up on a hinge and the tail opens and you can put like tanks in two at a time. You know what I mean?
It's about.
They're like the biggest cargo thing. I mean, the biggest thing in the sky that can fly. It's ridiculously huge. They make tons and tons of noise, and it's a fixed wing aircraft, right? Red light on the right, green on the left, the whole thing. Normal aircraft, especially when flying over Massachusetts, by the way, not a war zone where they're going to turn their lights off. And they make tons of noise. We hear them coming from New York, right? before you even see them. And so everyone goes, okay, wait a minute. C-5? Come on. You know, like, that doesn't make any sense at all. I wasn't thinking alien until you said it was a C-5. You know what I mean? Like, sure. Now suddenly your official comment on what that was is so ludicrously stupid that now I'm going to all kinds of places in my head that I wasn't going before. Had they just looked at the video and said, you know what, I really don't know what it is, then I would have gone, oh, well, who knows, right? But they can't say that. They can't say we don't know. What's flying over Massachusetts airspace that we can't identify? No one wants to hear that from our government. So we get told it's a C-5, which it's not. I don't know what it is, but it's not that.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, where you have the official, quote unquote, the official response from a government agency or the Air Force, and that can really drive a person in one direction or another. You can drop it, you can leave it as is, and you just don't question it anymore. Or you're like, things aren't adding up. A C-5, no, wasn't making any noise, didn't line up. Just a lot of the characteristics of that sighting really are not driving that home for me. And so I think that, that can definitely drive people in one direction or another, those official reports.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, we all make our own decisions and so on. And that's the beauty of it. And we live in a world now too, where social media is more powerful than traditional media. People don't trust reporters anymore. They don't trust news outlets. They trust what they see and hear on social media that goes viral, that may or may not be true and otherwise. So it's a dangerous time. And that's probably a big part of the reason that our country's in the trouble that it's in, is that every one of us have become reporters and editors in chief. And most of us aren't qualified to do that or handle it. So we're spreading all this stuff. And when you're into these fringe topics already, boy, it just gets tricky, because I know I'm so careful. When someone shows me a video of anything, I'm just like, hey, if I wasn't there when it was filmed, I can't comment other than to say that's interesting. You know, I can't say for certain, well, that's a ghost or that's a UFO or that's a Sasquatch footprint, because people fake stuff all the time and it makes our lives harder every time it happens. You know, they go, oh, well, see, this is fake. So what you're doing is fake. And you go, damn it. That guy, you know, that kid with the cell phone running out there in the woods. Damn you.
You know, and all those things are make it really difficult to sift and get to the bottom of things in the pursuit of truth and what actually happened. We do have a tendency to lean towards, you know, we kind of have that appeal to emotion. We lean towards what we know, but there's also that little bit of you that wants it to be true. But I think that that's a good, great instinct for you to question and be like, well, I don't know about that. You know, it's a good instinct to have.
We should all be skeptics. We should all be skeptical and look at things with a, you know, a certain amount of critical thinking, but, that doesn't mean dismiss everything. It just means that we have to at least ask those questions when presented with something that could be incredible.
Absolutely. Well, it's been our pleasure to have you on. We appreciate the points of view that you've submitted and the different stories that you've shared with us. You're very knowledgeable. We actually love the stuff that you've put out. And I want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find you and some of your latest work.
Yeah, well, my website is jeffbelanger.com, and the podcast is New England Legends, which you can get anywhere you can get podcasts. And that's just been fun. You know, every week we tell a new story. You know, we use voice actors and music and sound effects and very much like a produced thing. They're only like 10, 12 minutes each. And I love that. I love looking at a new story every single week because it's a new perspective each time. And it's been really cool to build this community of people that are just passionate about it, you know? So I'm on social media, you know, Facebook and Twitter, if you're into that as well. And I'm always happy to swap stories with people and explore this, because I'm just on the journey with everyone else. You know, I don't pretend to have some insight beyond any other person, but I do love the topic a lot.
You know, that format of that 10 to 12 minute podcast, I've listened to a couple of your stories, and it's just a perfect, nice little bite-sized morsel, kind of whet the appetite, and, you know, it doesn't take a lot of time, and it's rewarding for the amount of time that it is.
Yeah, thank you. It's incredible, those 10, 12 minutes, how many hours go into them, because it's, you know, it's researched, and it's put out there and edited and everything else. And we're like, man, people are like, oh, 12 minutes. Like, yeah, you know how many, it's like gotta be 10 hours at least on each one. But I love doing it because God knows it doesn't pay anything.
I believe you. So it doesn't seem like you have any shortage of material, and
nope.
It sounds like you still have stories rolling in from time to time. So that makes it exciting and keeps you on your toes.
Yeah. It's been, we've done this for 80 consecutive weeks. We have not missed a Thursday at noon for 80 weeks, which is a year and a half now. I have no danger of running out of stories. No problem at all.
Great. Thanks again for coming on. We'll link up your site and your information on our site. And thanks so much.
Thank you guys.
All right, everybody, that's going to conclude the latest episode from Lost River Legends. If you feel so inclined, we would appreciate if you would like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Share this episode with someone who has never heard of the Bridgewater Triangle or has never heard of King Philip's War. If you have just a couple minutes, head over to iTunes, find the channel, and give us a shout out. We would appreciate it. And lastly, if you've had a strange encounter, something you don't know, lights in the sky, a UFO, missing time, anything of the sort, please email us at lostriverlegends@gmail.com. And until next time, everyone stay safe and everyone stay happy. Take care.